Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and happy Earth Day to you. Today is April 22nd. You know it's the 50th Earth Day? The first one was on April 22nd, 1970. So if I've got my math
49th.
Right, let's see. 40, no, but 70, because it would be the 50th, Bill, right? Because this is 2019. So if the first one was in 70, then you complete
your
that
math
set
is pretty
of
good.
10.
All I know is that everybody's gearing up to celebrate number 50 next April. So.
Yeah, I would say that's
this is, we're back at Y2K.
We are really splitting hairs here. But I would say that next year is the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
Right.
And this year is the 50th Earth Day.
So. Whatever it is, it's a good day to remember that when 20 million Americans turn out in the streets as they did on that day in 1970, it's enough to change the politics of a country. That's why we got Richard Nixon to sign the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and that's what we need to do now if we're ever going to get a handle on climate.
And a lot of progress has been made on those traditional pollution sources, though not enough, and certainly not evenly in strata of society, but something no one was focusing on much in 1970, climate change, often called global warming, is seen by many, obviously, as a major, if not the major, if not an existential threat to life, or at least quality of life, as we know it in many places. Now, all this week on The Brian Lehrer Show, we will look at different aspects of environmental science and policy and life, starting right now with maybe the best-known environmentalist of our time, Bill McKibben, who helped to bring global warming into the mainstream conversation 30 years ago in 1989 with his seminal book, The End of Nature. Now, Bill McKibben has a new book, largely about how artificial intelligence could change what it means to be human, but also about global warming. It's called Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? Bill, always good to have you, even when we're arguing fine points of mathematics. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, what a pleasure to be with you again.
And the first part of the book is about climate before you get to AI, so let's us take it in that order, too. This is your 18th book on climate change. What shifted in how you think about the nature of the problem since 1989?
Well, two things. One, the thing we got wrong in 1989 was underestimating how hard and how fast climate change was going to come at us. Scientists by nature tend to be conservative. We thought the stuff we're seeing now, half the summer sea ice in the Arctic gone, the oceans 30% more acidic, we thought that was 2080, 2090, not 2019. I think the other thing that's shifted is my naive sense that our governments and leaders would react to a crisis like this if warned by scientists. And instead, we've had 30 years with not much. And the reason, as I talk about at some length in Falter, is because mostly the fossil fuel industry, the richest industry on Earth, organized itself to tell the most consequential lie in human history, a sort of full-on PR offensive to make people believe that there was some doubt about what was going on when there wasn't. And that's cost us 30 years. It means that our list of choices now about how to deal with this no longer include the kind of small course corrections we could have made in the late 1980s. Now it's things like the Green New Deal or nothing. We have to come at this at scale.
And I want to get into the Green New Deal as we go, but you reference public polling, which indicates that the majority of Americans believe climate change is happening and are willing to make sacrifices to address it, they say. So if that's the case, why is climate-based environmental regulation still so politically polarizing in D.C.?
Well, because the oil and gas industry basically purchased one of our two political parties and intimidated the other. The Koch brothers, our biggest oil and gas barons by far, are also by far the biggest sources of political money in our system. No one's dared cross them on the GOP for a long time. And so at the federal level, things have been very, very bottled up. We see some of the same sort of stuff happen at the state and local level as utilities and fossil fuel interests try to intimidate local officials too. It's a little harder because it's more spread out, and hence we're seeing some more action, including here in New York, where we've seen things like the divestment fight and most recently last week this Climate Mobilization Act that would really go after emissions in big buildings.
New York's pension funds have divested from fossil fuel companies, right?
Absolutely, or at least begun the process, and that's a big deal. Even here, those things are hard. You see the continuing fight, for instance, over this Williams pipeline thing through the Rockaways. I mean, this is should be a no-brainer. No one should be locking us into another 40 or 50 years of dependence on fossil fuel. But, you know, it's you have some sympathy for your average politician. These guys hit hard. They're big players.
Talk about the pipeline through the Rockaways, which some people know about, but a lot of people don't know about. I think part of the thinking for developing that kind of infrastructure is natural gas is not in the same category as oil and coal. I know that's controversial.
That's what we used to think.
And also with Indian Point going to shut down, our additional or replacement energy needs need to come from somewhere because we're not up to scale yet on renewables.
So this is what we used to think, that natural gas was, you know, it was like the other white meat. It was the cleaner alternative here. But in the last 10 years, a great deal of science, led by people at Cornell, actually, really crack scientists there, have demonstrated that so much methane, a potent greenhouse gas, is emitted in the fracking process that it's as bad or worse than burning coal to generate power. And the right response is the response, say, that Governor Cuomo gave when the utilities were trying to hold him up in Westchester County. He said, no, we're going to commit serious money to putting air source heat pumps and things in people's houses so that they don't have to fear a cold winter. This is clearly where we're headed. The city's plan on response to climate is all about electrification. That's what we have to do, and fast. And the good news is that we can see over the next decades where all that power is going to come from. I mean, the engineers have now made sun and wind the cheapest way to generate power on this planet. And God bless, you know, the Atlantic Ocean. There's plenty of wind out there to make sure that we're well supplied.
How encouraged, and my guest, if you're just joining us, is environmentalist Bill McKibben here on this Earth Day 2019. His new book is called Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? And we'll get into the artificial intelligence aspects of the book as we go. But how encouraged are you by the Green New Deal movement? I think it's new enough, at least as a prominent thing, that it's not even in the book, or is it?
It is. It made the book. So did the other great upsurges of rebellion around the world right now. You may have seen stuff from the UK last week. London was paralyzed by this Extinction Rebellion. And of course, you've probably been following the sterling example of young Greta Thunberg, the Swedish schoolgirl who's now led millions of young people out of school on strike to demand climate action. All of these are a sign that people are getting fed up. And this movement building is really our only hope. We have to figure out a way to speed up this process of transition. Everybody knows where we're going. 50 years from now, the world's gonna run on sun and wind because it's free. The question is, how long are we gonna take to get there? And on current trends, the world that we run on sun and wind 50 years from now is going to be a broken world. It's already breaking. I mean, we remember Hurricane Sandy, but partly that's because there's a lot of TV cameras here. The same thing's happening someplace around the world almost every day now. Right now, we should have lots of room in our hearts for our brothers and sisters in Mozambique and Malawi and Zimbabwe. The cyclone that hit there last month has been described as the worst disaster in the history of the Southern Hemisphere.
And we can take phone calls for Bill McKibben at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. But I want to know how encouraged you are by the Green New Deal movement, because it seems to me it's a very explicit marrying of environmental protection and social justice in a way that we haven't seen in mainstream politics before, right? Like in the past, there was often more of an oppositional framing of which is more important, environmental protection or economic growth.
Yep.
And sometimes environmentalism was seen as an elite white concern. The Green New Deal seeks to marry social justice and anti-global warming environmentalism.
Brian, you're one of the few people who's commented on this, I think, that sort of figured out the thing at the root of it. You'll remember Naomi Klein wrote a book a couple of years ago called This Changes Everything, arguing that we were going to have to try and deal with that the climate crisis was so huge that solving it would require solving some of our other problems. Put another way, would allow us to deal with some of our other problems. And that's what the Green New Deal, I think, envisions. Look, if we were going to make this transition in the time we have, it would take a great deal of labor. That's why there's a jobs guarantee in that Green New Deal. And as I try to point out in the book, it's a lot of the same forces that have led to this 30 years of climate denial that have also led to the unbelievable levels of inequality that are the other kind of statistical anomaly about the age in which we live. It's not like these things are disconnected. It's that same incredible belief against all fact that markets solve all problems, that we should just leave corporations free to do whatever they want, that's landed us in both these pickles.
Explain that a little more, though, because a lot of people might think, well, gee, economic growth, not equally, but raises all boats compared to economic stagnation. And we certainly know that economic growth of the economy as a whole has led, and for decades now, to most of that growth going to the top 20% or so. And yet economic stagnation would be even worse, presumably, and environmental conversion, environmental regulation, is extremely expensive and burdensome on the economy, the usual economics goes.
At this point, I think it's very clear, and I don't think you could find an economist almost who'd argue with it. The cost of not doing anything about something like climate change is much higher than the cost of even badly designed inefficient programs, much less good smart ones like the Green New Deal. If you were looking for a source for jobs in the decades to come, nothing is going to beat this necessary transition, the one that physics is requiring, towards local renewable energy sources. No one's going to put their house on a boat and send it to China to get insulated. That's work that has to happen here, and it's work that is good, important, should be well-paid and protected work. And if we do it, we will benefit economically on every front.
We'll continue with Bill McKibben in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with environmentalist Bill McKibben. His new book is called Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? I'll mention that he mentioned Naomi Klein, author of No Logo and This Changes Everything and other books, and they're going to be doing an appearance together tonight at 7 at the Strand Bookstore. That's the Strand in the Village, Broadway and East 12th Street. For admission details, go to strandbooks.com. I think you need to buy a book or a gift card in order to attend this. But just so you know, that is happening at the Strand tonight at 7 o'clock. Bill McKibben talking about his new book with Naomi Klein. Let's take a phone call. Andrew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andrew.
Oh, hello, Brian. Hello, Mr. McKibben.
Hello there.
Can you hear me?
Indeed.
Oh, good. I wanted to point out that one personal choice we can all make above policy is to go vegan. The animal agriculture industry has been subsidized as heavily as the fossil fuel industry, and it's an apocalypse. And just as a very personal thing that if you feel powerless today that you can do right now is to stop eating animals and animal products. And if Mr. McKibben would like to comment on that, I'll take it off air. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Eating lower on the food chain is a really good idea. And if you're not ready to go all the way, then you can look up some of the work that people are doing at places like the Reducitarian movement, where they're talking about eating less meat in the course of a day. That said, I think it's important for all of us to understand that having waited this long, we're not going to solve climate change by a series of individual actions. I mean, my house is covered with solar panels. I'm proud of that, but I've stopped trying to fool myself that that's how we're going to deal with climate change. The most important thing an individual can do, not that their individual choices aren't important, but the most important thing an individual can do is be a little less of an individual. Join together with others in movements of the size that are necessary to really reorient policy. That's why we started 350.org. That's why people are working on the Green New Deal. That's the level where we got to go.
Frank in Dover, you're on WNYC with Bill McKibben. Hi, Frank.
Hey, guys. I was wondering what your thoughts are on nuclear energy. It seems like Gen 4 nuclear reactors, which are safe for meltdowns and use nuclear fuel as energy, could be a good solution. I know Rick Perry at the Department of Energy has been putting some work behind it, and there's some bipartisan senators working on nuclear energy, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on that as a viable alternative.
Well, just because Rick Perry's for it is not a good reason, I suppose, to discount it altogether. I don't think that nuclear power is going to play a big role in what's coming forward. And I think that that's partly for the reasons that we know about, but mostly because of cost. The price of a solar panel fell 90% in the last decade. Meanwhile, the cost of a nuclear reactor just keeps going up, 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 up. And so my guess is that we're going to turn in the short time that we have to sun and wind. But there are people who, you know, really smart people, Jim Hansen, the great climate scientist, maybe chief among them, who hold out hope that there will be some new generation of nuclear technology that might make a difference. When it comes along, I guess it'll be a good idea to take a look at it. But for now, man, it's sun and wind that are the off-ramp here.
Your book is not just about climate change. It's also about artificial intelligence and where to dive in there. You compare weak AI with strong AI. Where do you want to go?
Well, you know what I'd like to – I think what I'd like to say is that there is about a quarter of this book that's about the new emerging tech stuff. And it's because those – threats feel to me sort of the way that climate change felt to me in 1989, as things that clearly represented enormous shifts in how we were going to view ourselves and the world around us, but that we were not paying sufficient attention to, that we hadn't begun to think about. The part of this that's furthest along now is the advent of human genetic engineering. As you know, in October, a Chinese doctor produced the first two designer babies on this planet, a move that was shocking enough that much of the scientific community has been kind of trying now in retrospect to begin putting some limits on this sort of work. But there are plenty of people out there, especially in Silicon Valley, many of them very high profile, who've made very clear their hope for a world before long where we'll be improving our children in utero. And if we do that, then I think the threat, just as climate change represented what I said in 30 years ago was kind of the end of nature, so this represents kind of the end of human nature.
You're right. When we engineer and design, we turn people into a form of technology, and obsolescence is an utterly predictable feature of every technology we've ever seen.
It's exactly, you've got the key point. So imagine that you go into the clinic in a few years with your credit card and you engineer your child in embryo to maybe it's, you know, affect its serotonin level so it's happier, or try to add a few IQ points if we're figuring out how to do that. Then wait 5 years and you go back in the clinic for child number two. Well, I mean, technology progresses. That's what it does, right? And so now the upgrade package is considerably better. What does that make child number one? I mean, child number one is now, you know, iPhone 6 and so on forever and ever. This is a step we do not need to take because we can deal with genetic illness in other ways. We can prevent its transmission.
You don't want to even see genetic-based medicine?
Oh, no. I say in the book, I do. I think that somatic, what they call somatic use of genetic medicine on people who have been born who are in need of it, is just a perfectly normal extension of medicine now. What isn't is the attempt to induce heritable genetic modification in children. That's something entirely different.
Some part of your book is about the problem with sufficient or successful, I should say, messaging, right? That fighting the climate deniers, all of that, there's public complacency, there's public doubt that's been sown. Is too much apocalyptic rhetoric working against your side and working against science and acceptance of science? I'll give you an example. There's an op-ed in the Times today, New York Times, by William Gale, past president of the American Meteorological Association. And he quotes the National Climate Assessment itself, which warned of how bad this is getting, as an official government document that Trump denounced, but this came from the government, how much it, you know, it's about how much Earth will eventually warm, obviously, and how rapidly oceans will rise, when and where extreme weather and water shortages might occur, and whether potential tipping points like the collapse of the Antarctic ice sheets will in fact occur. In other words, William Gale, past president of the American Meteorological Association, is laying all of those things out as unknowns, even in the context of what we know, which is that global warming and man-made global warming is real. So it's still unknown how rapidly oceans will rise, how much Earth will eventually warm, where and when weather extremes and water shortages might occur, things like that. So how much might you have to account for uncertainties in the science on these questions of degree in the politics,
sure,
in order to paradoxically fight public complacency?
So let me just say a couple of things. First is that, as I was saying earlier, scientists have consistently underestimated, not overestimated, how bad this was going to be. But you don't even at this point need to worry about sort of estimates of the future. I mean, look what happens every year now. We've had the five warmest years on record in the last 5 years, and they've brought with them a freight of almost unbelievable. It's the head of Chubb Insurance, the CEO, said in his annual report last week, it's become biblical. I think what he means is a kind of storm like the hurricane off the East Coast last year that dropped the water equivalent of all of Chesapeake Bay on the Carolinas, or the 1 year before, Harvey in Houston, that was the biggest rainstorm in American history. It dropped 5 feet of water on parts of Houston. These are kind of things that can only happen once you've raised the temperature and hence increased the amount of water vapor that the atmosphere can hold. And you could go on telling stories like this all day. We all got to watch a city in California literally called paradise literally turn into hell inside half an hour last fall. You can't unsee that once you've seen it. So I don't think that, you know, I don't think we need to worry too much about gloom and doom. I think all we need to do is be honest. And in the same way that you would like your oncologist to be honest with you, probably a good idea to let your local neighborhood physicist or atmospheric chemist do the same thing.
We want to thank Bill McKibben, whose new book is called Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? And again, he'll speak about the book at 7 o'clock tonight at the Strand Bookstore with Naomi Klein. And for admission details, go to strandbooks.com and find out how to get in to see Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein. And thanks so much for being one of our guests on Earth Day.
Brian, thank you for keeping this calm salon of the air in operation. A real pleasure as always.